Didn't really hear Case and all that.
Oh, pirates, yes, they rob I. Sold I to the merchant ships. Minutes after they took I from the bottomless pit. But my hand was made strong by the hand of the Almighty. We fought in this generation triumphantly. Won't you help to sing these songs of freedom? Is all I ever have redemption song, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Ooh, some say it's just a part of it, and we've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help me sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever have, redemption songs, redemption songs, redemption songs. Emancipate yourselves from mental slavery. None but ourselves can free our mind. Have no fear for atomic energy, 'cause none of them can stop the time. How long shall they kill our prophets while we stand aside and look? Some say it's just a part of it, and we've got to fulfill the book. Won't you help me sing these songs of freedom? 'Cause all I ever had, redemption songs, all I ever had, redemption songs, these songs of freedom. Songs of freedom.
Thank you. Welcome to the Unitarian Universalist Community Church of Hendricks County. My name is Dave Cravat, and this is Monica Smith. The song we chose for tonight was Redemption Song, written by Bob Marley. We are a progressive congregation consisting of people of many beliefs, some with a religious background, some with none, some who believe in a God, some who do not. Our beliefs are diverse but inclusive. We have no shared creed, but instead a shared covenant, including our seven principles, which you'll find posted on the wall. Whatever your faith, whomever you love, we welcome you with all your truths and your doubts, your worries and your hopes. We are a community that embraces freedom of thought, where people come together to encourage each other to spiritual growth that makes for peace, ethical living, and community service. During these Chautauqua sessions, a collection plate will not be passed, but donations are graciously accepted. Donation plates are located at the back table near the entrance. Over by Jeff, you can wave Jeff. There's Jeff, plates right next to him. Thank you, you're welcome. Near the entrance and on the small table near the door leading to our fellowship hall. If you have any questions about our church, feel free to explore the literature on the tables. You can also speak with any of us wearing a name tag, or me, even though I'm not wearing my name tag. And now I turn things over to Barbara Whitehead, who will serve as our moderator this evening.
Welcome. And we'll try that again. Welcome. Hi, and happy belated Juneteenth. Are you all familiar with Juneteenth? So we have the holiday which celebrates the day that slaves in Galveston, Texas first heard the news. Not only that the war was over, but they first heard the news that they were free. 2 years after the Emancipation Proclamation, so June 19th, 1865. This year, to mark that day, to mark Juneteenth, Congress held the first hearings on reparations in the House in over a decade. So what they were talking about was not actually any bill on reparations. It was a discussion, very Congress-like, a discussion about setting up a commission to discuss the issue. So we'll see how that goes. But given all of this, Juneteenth and what's going on in Congress, it makes today's talk by Jim Mulholland very timely at this point. Jim is a former minister, now turned public atheist, which I'd never really heard that term before. While in the ministry, he wrote three books, including two bestsellers with our own Phil Gully, whom he met when both were students at the Christian Theological Seminary in Indianapolis, the first being If Grace is True in 2003, and the second If God is Love, 2004. These books, as one reviewer noted, exposed thousands to a kinder, gentler version of Christianity. That was just one stop, however, on Jim's spiritual journey. After leaving Christianity and becoming an atheist, or perhaps more accurately, a post-religious person, which I think is how you identified yourself in an article, Jim wrote Leaving Your Religion, A Practical Guide to Becoming Non-Religious, 2013, as a guidebook for others walking the post-religion path. Jim's journey continued. It led him to become the executive director of Companion Community Development Alternatives, a small NGO doing collaborative development work in Central America. And along the way, his family grew to include 6 children and 11 grandchildren, of which 5 are biracial. Being an older white man with a 12-year-old black daughter has forced Jim to confront the privilege and racism within himself and his family, his society, the community at large. He works through these and other issues in his blog, notetomywhiteself.wordpress.com. Please join me in welcoming today Jim Mulholland for what will certainly be a most interesting talk.
Good evening. As Barbara was talking, I realized that, you know, you kind of journey through life adding and subtracting identities, trying to figure out who you are and how to explain yourself to others, and perhaps tonight I'm adding one more, because while it's probably not in any of my biographies, I realized that perhaps one of the key identifiers for me in recent years has been the term recovering racist. And you know, that's become important for 2 reasons. One, because it's recognition that there are deep prejudices and biases in me that I cannot escape. And also that I want to escape them, that I want to recover from them, I want to change them. And so I think it's important tonight to begin with that I am not here to speak as an expert on racism. While I have participated in racism all my life, I've been largely oblivious to it. This does make me, however, perhaps an expert on white ignorance and white indifference and certainly white resistance to talking about and understanding race. So what I say today is less pontificating and perhaps more confession and repentance. In one sense, I'm a recovering racist, speaking tonight to hopefully other recovering racists and perhaps to those racists still in denial. And having sat with friends in AA meetings, I know this talk must begin with the fourth step, which is a searching and fearless moral inventory of myself. So here it goes. I deeply apologize to those whom I have directly or indirectly, intentionally or unintentionally harmed by my racist words, actions, and attitudes. And I pledge to honestly examine my past, present, and future actions, and to listen to the real experiences of those impacted by my racism. I will listen when people of color point out my racism and assume that they are right. And I promise to act on what I hear and learn, becoming an opponent rather than a passive participant in systemic racism. And I hope tonight you share that apology. You see, apologizing doesn't come easy to white folk. We've been able to avoid it for hundreds of years. And like most recovering racists, I once thought an apology unnecessary. I didn't think I had a race problem. For the first 50 years of my life, I thought of myself as colorblind. And though I had only a handful of black friends, I considered them proof of my enlightenment. And while I realized that vestiges of racism remained in our society, I thought white supremacy was the behavior of a few miscreant white people. And like many, I consider the election of Barack Obama evidence that racism was largely a thing of the past. Until a few years ago, I would have been offended if you had accused me of being a racist. Today, I understand that most racists are blithely unaware of their racism. By allowing the term racist and white supremacist to become synonymous, we've robbed black people of the language to call out the daily microaggressions of systemic racism. We've created the illusion that those white people who do not use the N-word and are critical of those who do are the pinnacle of racial enlightenment. And we've excused ourselves from having to examine our deeply ingrained prejudices and ignored the evidences of our privilege. Most white people in America are convinced that race really isn't a problem. And this deception is at the heart of the racial divides in our society. Indeed, Dr. King once wrote, "Shallow understanding of people of goodwill is more frustrating than the absolute misunderstanding of people of ill will." Now think about that. According to one of the black men that many of us revere, the white supremacist was not his chief concern. He was worried about people like you and I. He went on to write, "I have been gravely disappointed with the white moderate. I've almost reached the regrettable conclusion that the Negro's great stumbling block in his stride toward freedom is not the Ku Klux Klanner, but the white moderate, who is more devoted to order than to justice, who prefers a negative peace, which is the absence of tension, to a positive peace, which is the presence of justice." He's talking about me. Like most racists, I thought the lack of tension around race was evidence that racism was rare. Remember that. When someone suggests that the tensions we're experiencing today are negative and divisive, they're only negative for those of us who don't want to see a problem. And they're only divisive because they disrupt the closely guarded white consensus that racism isn't an issue any longer. The white person who refuses to see the racial injustices built into our system is blind. But that's not a good thing. I used to think being colorblind was a badge of honor. But it never occurred to me that this was the only situation where I considered being blind, literally or metaphorically, a positive characteristic. Indeed, if I had been physically colorblind, I would have thought of that as a disability. And yet I convince myself that not being able to see the color of another person and how that impacted my attitudes and opinions and actions was a positive thing. And this blindness allowed me to miss countless examples in my personal life, in the world around me, where blatant or systemic racism negatively impacted people of color. And even more damning, it allowed me to obscure all the ways in which the whiteness of my skin evoked power and privilege. But unfortunately, I do not stand before you today as one moved by the words of Dr. King or changed by listening to black people or provoked by a careful study of racism and white privilege. When you do not perceive a problem, you don't look for a solution. I stand here today aware that if not for a single event in my life, I might have continued in my self-assured confidence. I stand here today because on November 6, 2010, I became the father of a black daughter named Ella. And being Ella's father changed my life. Now, this is not to suggest that having a black child or family member or friend automatically infuses your life with racial understanding. I wish that were the case. Indeed, I became Ella's father when she was 3 and told Ella's mother and my new bride that having raised 3 daughters, I brought considerable expertise to Ella's life. I made my claim completely unaware of how different and difficult it is to parent a black child in the United States. And it would be over a year before I became fully aware of my lack of preparation. My epiphany happened on a spring day in 2012 at the elementary school in Speedway, Indiana. On that day, my wife and I took our 4-year-old black daughter to visit the school and where she would be attending kindergarten. We wanted to see the building and the classroom and meet the teachers. So we called and requested a tour. When we arrived, the white principal ushered us to her office and began to tell us about the school. And she went in great detail about the special education programs, how they were highly rated, and how they attempted to incorporate their special needs students into the general population of the school. And then she took us on a tour of the building. We made a brief stop at the kindergarten room to observe the class and its teacher. And then we made a much longer visit to the special needs classroom, and the teacher greeted us warmly and engaged with our daughter. And they escorted us from the school and thanked us for coming. And as we walked away, all 3 of us were on edge. Something wasn't right. It wasn't until that afternoon when we had time to talk that we realized what was wrong. The entire special needs class had been black and brown children. The principal had assumed from the moment she saw our daughter that she would be a special needs student, that she was less capable. Realizing what had happened, my wife and I were enraged, and my wife said, "She will go to that school over my dead body." Regrettably, we responded to racism by using our privilege in the worst possible way. We took our daughter and we fled to another school system. We did what white people can always do. We removed ourselves from the tension of racism. I'm ashamed to admit that we never thought to use our privilege to confront the principal or speak to the superintendent. We did what white people have done for centuries. We abandoned those black and brown children to their fate while protecting our own daughter. See, much of what I've learned about racism, I've learned by having my white privilege exposed. It's interesting, when I tell this story to black people, they begin shaking their heads the moment I mention the principal's accolades for the special needs program. They know what's coming. When I tell it to white people, they, like my wife and I, often don't make the connections until I talk about the makeup of the special needs class, and they often respond with disbelief, implying I must have misinterpreted the principal's remarks or misunderstood her intent. And you see, this is the problem with systemic racism in America. Unless you directly experience its ugliness, it's always easy to discount. Hearing is not believing. Most white people, upon hearing stories of racism, instinctually doubt and dispute them. And when we acknowledge them, we apply that they are an oddity rather than a common occurrence. Seeing is not believing. When white people see videos of unarmed black men who are shot and killed by police, many do not see this as evidence of racial inequity. Many white people say, if you're doing nothing wrong, you've nothing to fear from the police. And this is such a powerful argument because it's experientially true for us. If you've never been the target of systemic racism, it seems imaginary. There are more comfortable explanations for what you're seeing. Anything but racism. And this has been my chief frustration as I've talked to white people about racism and white privilege. There is no adequate replacement for experience. If you assume you're colorblind and the society is generally fair, it's easy to ignore evidence to the contrary. Too often it takes an epiphany. I went into that school assuming our educational system was colorblind. And even when I left, that assumption made it difficult for me to recognize what I'd seen and what I'd heard. Only later, when I had time to reflect on what had happened, did I identify it as systemic racism. And like all epiphanies, that day changed my understanding of the world. Vicariously, for a brief moment, I experienced the pain of millions of black parents who have experienced at the hands of white folk. After all, there's nothing worse than watching your own child misjudged and mistreated. If one such moment could so enrage me, I could only imagine what repeated experiences of such diminishment must cost people of color. For me, racism was something glimpsed from the window of a moving train, there and then gone. For blacks, racism is like being tied to the tracks and crushed by car after car after car of a long freight train. My vicarious experiences of racism through my daughter have given me a rare window into a world most white people never see. It is a world I needed to understand, both to be a good father and to be a good person. And embarrassed by our ignorance, my wife and I began to read and listen, to look for every opportunity to better understand both ourselves and this thing called race. On that spring day in 2012, I began a journey that's led me to become an advocate for reparations, something that in 2011, I'd never even thought about. One of my earliest readings in this journey was Ta-Nehisi Coates' letter to his teenage son, Between the World and Me. It seemed a fitting, as I struggled with what it meant to be the parent of a black child, to read the thoughts of another parent of a black child. And reading such a book isn't comfortable for a white person. Since white people were not his audience, there was no attempt to assuage my tender sensibilities. It was eye-opening. In all the cultural references, I didn't understand. He was talking about a different world, though obviously a world that existed in parallel with mine. And I want to be frank. White people are idiots when it comes to race in America. We don't know the history of slavery. We don't understand how horribly black people were treated for generations. We don't realize how deeply embedded this abuse is in every American institution. We don't appreciate the tremendous wealth stripped from blacks and bestowed on us. Not only aren't we taught the truth about race in America, we are actually taught a false narrative intentionally designed to eliminate any guilt and escape any responsibility. Most of what I thought I knew about race was wrong. So let me mention just some of the most problematic misunderstandings. Slavery, as it would become in America, was a new version of slavery, unlike anything the world had ever known in its brutality and dehumanization. The slavery that developed in the New World was industrial slavery, where people were understood as commodities to be owned, sold, used up, and discarded. I also didn't know that industrial slavery was largely driven by the sweet tooth developed by middle-class Europeans. That Haiti once produced the sugar necessary to meet this demand, that enslaved persons were absolutely vital to this industry. So let's be perfectly clear. Millions of black people were ground up in the gears of industrial slavery so white people could have dessert. I didn't know that in 1791, nearly 500,000 enslaved black people in Haiti successfully rebelled and established the second oldest democracy in our hemisphere. I didn't know that Haiti at that time was considered the most valuable real estate in the world. And I didn't know that this island of rebellious enslaved people defeated one English and two French armies. And I didn't know that these events created such a fear in the United States that slavery in our nation would forever be enforced by horrible violence intended to keep enslaved persons from ever considering revolution here in the United States. The violent abuse of black people is foundational to our country's origins. Physically abusing black people is as American as baseball, hot dogs, apple pie, and Chevrolet. Indeed, it became before all of them. Now, I knew that slavery in the United States was driven by cotton. But I didn't know that the emergence of the United States as the wealthiest country in the world was directly connected to our ability to produce cotton through enslaved labor. I didn't know that cotton plantations were less like farms and more like concentration camps where black men, women, and children were worked to death. And I didn't know that the Civil War was about freeing black people from torture. I didn't know the history of Reconstruction in the South, which should really be called the re-enslavement of black America. I didn't know that we had black senators and representatives in Congress in the 1870s, and that for a brief moment, blacks experienced hope. I didn't realize that the KKK was created to destroy that moment of potential reparation. And I didn't know how many thousands of black people were murdered in the 10 years after the Civil War in order to restore the status quo. I didn't know that slavery really didn't end until 1940, that most African Americans were economically enslaved through systems of sharecropping, industrial chain gangs, vagrancy, and employment laws. And I didn't understand that lynching was the way this system was enforced, terrorizing any black person who challenged the status quo in any manner. And I didn't understand that lynchings were events where white families brought their children and a picnic basket designed to enculturate racism into white children. And I didn't know that the last mob lynching in America happened in 1981. Now, I could go on and on about the things I didn't know. And I wish I could say that this ignorance wasn't intentional, but I've also discovered that the whitewashing of slavery continues to this day. In 2015, the Texas Board of Education introduced new social studies curriculum that came under wide criticism for its whitewashing of the brutalities of slavery in the American South. And one of the more damning revisions was this statement: the treatment of enslaved Africans varied. Some slaves reported that their masters treated them kindly. Let's be perfectly clear. That is racist bullshit. An honest statement would read, in a vast majority of instances, enslaved people were brutalized, raped, tortured, and forever separated from parents, spouses, and children for the economic profit of their white abusers. Citing exceptions to this rule can have only one purpose: to diminish the horrors of slavery. Owning another human being was never an act of kindness. Considering another person as your property has always been evil. Indeed, the inclusion of the term masters in a modern textbook is blatantly racist. Those who owned slaves were not masters. They were monsters. Unfortunately, the whitewashing of slavery is epidemic in America. In conversations about slavery, I often hear white people comment that there were black slave owners, as if the rare exception proves that slavery was either less horrible or more justifiable. These type of statements are designed to misrepresent the realities of slavery. Imagine for a moment if someone said, the treatment of Jews in death camps varied. Some Jews reported that their guards treated them kindly. Even if this was true in some rare circumstance, such statements are morally abhorrent. They misdirect and obscure. They allow the hearer or reader to avoid confronting the horrific. And the history of the treatment of black people in America is horrific. Anyone who examines this history in any detail will quickly conclude that the discussion of reparations in Congress this week is long overdue. As Mitch McConnell so graphically demonstrated this week, if you want to quickly determine if a white person in the United States is comfortably racist, you can determine it with one single question. Ask them, should our nation pay reparations to black people for the enslavement, mistreatment, and economic exploitation of them and their ancestors over the past 400 years? If a white person immediately rejects that proposition, and most do, you can be fairly confident you've identified a comfortable racist. On the other hand, if they're willing to give this question serious consideration, you've probably identified an ethically responsible and racially conscious white person, and it's really that simple. There is no compelling argument against reparation. The studies and research have been done. The historians, the economists, and ethicists have spoken. While there can and should be debate about how reparations should be made, any white person who argues against reparations is either ignorant, they don't understand the history, immoral, they don't really care, racist, or all of the above. And additionally, if you encounter someone opposed to paying reparations, you can be fairly certain that they will offer one of the following three arguments. They will say, I have no responsibility. Neither I nor my ancestors owned slaves. And though I doubt most of these people have the genealogical support for such a claim, such evidence would be irrelevant. The economic advantages of slavery were not limited to slave owners. Though the highest concentration of millionaires in the United States in 1840 was the Mississippi Valley, the wealth created by slavery flowed north to textile mills, banks, and ultimately to every white family. Cotton was the single greatest economic driver in early American history. Without the millions of hours of tortured slave labor provided by black people, the American economy would not have thrived. The affluence generated by this labor, though unevenly divided amongst the white population, was limited to white people. You didn't have to be a slave owner to benefit from the enslavement of black people. You only had to be white. Indeed, this reality fueled the strong support in the South for defending slavery during the Civil War. Though only a quarter of Southern whites actually owned people, all of them were keenly aware of the benefits slavery produced. Indeed, at the time of the Civil War, enslaved people constituted the single greatest financial asset in the United States. While it's certainly possible to argue that some white people benefited more from slavery than others, it's difficult to argue that even the poorest white person has received no benefit, and it is irrefutable that the chief producers of this immense wealth, black people, received absolutely no financial benefit. More damning, in 1865, when they were freed from their legal bondage, they were paid no back wages. Most black people were left so destitute that they quickly became sharecroppers, which was often even more economically oppressive than slavery. For these reasons, the huge disparities in accumulated wealth and economic status between white people and black people today have their roots in this historic injustice. Those who argue against reparations because they or their ancestors didn't own black people are like those who fill their home with property they know was stolen from others. They may not be thieves, but they are hardly examples of integrity. Now, when forced to face this reality, opponents of reparations usually offer this second argument. Well, that was wrong, but it was a long time ago, and I haven't directly benefited from racial injustice. You see, once we've established the incredible injustice of the past, we have two choices. If we're ethical white people, we take responsibility for the actions of our ancestors. If we're immoral and racist, we throw our ancestors under the bus. We argue for our blamelessness. We pretend the oppression of black people ended in 1865. We ignore the evidence that all white people living today have directly benefited from racial injustice. As lucrative as slavery was, our ancestors weren't the greatest beneficiaries of the oppression of black people. The single greatest economic increase in American wealth was not in the 1800s. It happened between 1940 and 1970. Through the programs of the New Deal and the GI Bill, billions and billions of dollars of wealth was created. And a vast majority of this wealth was intentionally limited by governmental policy to white people. If you're white and you bought a home or grew up in a home purchased between 1934 and 1977, you likely benefited from government programs that awarded millions of dollars solely to white people. If you inherited a home purchased during those years, you reaped the spoils of racial injustice. If you, your parents, or grandparents went to college between 1944 and 1964, you likely benefited from government programs that excluded black people from millions of dollars of educational grants. If you, your parents, or grandparents have received Social Security benefits, you've likely benefited from a program that initially excluded up to 65% of all black people. It's difficult to find a single government policy between 1877 and 1977 that didn't give preferential treatment to white people or just exclude black people. Indeed, most white people today are recipients of one of the greatest governmental affirmative action programs in history. And since any argument for equity would require an equal distribution of this government largesse, we can fairly say that the greatest recipients of racial injustice are not long dead slave owners, but middle class white people today. Now, when forced to face this reality, those who oppose reparations usually default to a more racist rhetoric. They often offer this third argument: well, that wasn't fair, but what can you do? You just can't give black people money, they just waste it. Or some other generally disparaging remark about black people. Once we've established the incredible injustice of the present, we have two choices. If we're ethical white people, we take responsibility for the injustices of the present system and we seek to rectify them. But if we're immoral and racist, we throw black people under the bus. In arguing for their inadequacy and incompetency, we verify our ancestry. Like our forefathers, we justify the oppression of black people with the same paternal racist rhetoric, and we miss the obvious. Once you've acknowledged the resources were stolen, what the victims do with the compensation is irrelevant. It's their money. And it's time for white people who are ethically responsible and racially conscious to voice our support for the payment of reparations. It's time for our nation to finally pay its debt to the black people upon whose backs we've built the most prosperous nation in human history. And it's time to ask black people to tell us how they want to make us to make those payments. It's far past time. And when some people complain of the injustice of it all, we who are ethically responsible and racially conscious must identify that oppression for what it has always been: racist and immoral. Now, like any recovering racist, I am passionate about exposing what once held me in its grips of calling out what others ignore or justify. I was blind, and now I see. And I can see the ugliness of my racism and white privilege, and the countless ways it did and does damage to others and to myself. And I understand that I can no longer tolerate even a little racism in my life. For me, this is intensely personal. I do not want my daughter to grow up in a racist household, in a racist community, in a racist state, in a racist nation, in a racist world. But more importantly, I do not want any sons and daughters to grow up in that kind of world. It has to end. Now, with our generation, with me, with you, with us.
Does this work?
I have a brother-in-law who's black. He's been in our family for about 20 years, and I've traveled with him and my brother. So I've seen some things that I might not have been aware of, sure. But for Harold. So then when earlier this year, an acquaintance on Facebook called me a racist, my first reaction was to deny it. And I cannot remember just what I said. Part of the thread that was going was about slavery and crime and so forth. I might have even said that black people had slaves too. But instead, I asked this woman why she would say that. And so she pointed to a couple of things that I had said, and I mentioned to, I'm an attorney, so I think I know credible sites. And I mentioned to her that what I had commented came from some scholarly articles. And she wanted to know the source. And I thought, oh crap, just because I've read this by a white professor at Harvard or Stanford or Columbia or wherever, doesn't mean it doesn't have racist undertones in it. Yeah. So over and over, and I know it happens at least weekly with me, I go back to what she said to me, and I thought, I was raised to be a racist.
Right.
That's not an excuse, but
yeah.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Thank you. That's a... It's a powerful confession. Thank you. I appreciate that.
What happened in 1981? You said one of the last public lynchings in America was in 1981.
Yeah, it was in Alabama. And I don't remember all the details, but it's largely considered the last of what is considered the classical lynchings, where a group gathered, kind of took vigilante justice, took a black person and lynched them. One of the things, if you want to read an interesting book about lynching, there's a book by the name of In the Hands of People Unknown, which details the history of lynching. And one of the interesting things about lynching is it was originally kind of vigilante justice, and then it became something that the courts and sheriffs largely participated in. And then it actually transitioned into other kinds of things. And if you've seen documentaries like 13th and some of those things, there's some pretty good arguments that the mechanisms around lynchings have just always changed. They've changed forms. But essentially what the lynching is an act of governmental, societal, approved vigilantism that is designed to terrorize the black community and to force the black community back in its place. So that's always been its intention. And so 81 was the last example of that in more the classical form, but I'd be careful in just saying, oh, now we solve that, because I think lynching, as this book points out, has taken new forms. How do you terrorize? How do you keep people in their place? There are new ways to do that, you know.
Is one of them the current system, the prison system we now have?
I think so. You know, the basic act of profiling that it's been proven time and again that that's ingrained, embedded in our policing system, profiling. So in almost every locality in the United States, you can document that black people are going to be pulled over much more often, they're going to be searched much more often than almost any kind of negative behavior, and that that's all designed in some way to terrorize a black population, you know, to keep them in place. So I just want to be careful. On one hand, I want to say, thank goodness 81 was the last one, but that's my lifetime. You know, it's not something in our historic past. But I also want to be careful not suggesting that the mechanisms that drove lynching aren't still in action in other ways. So.
Thank you, Jim. I have 2 points that I'd like you to consider and comment on. The first is, when the Constitution was written, and I guess blacks at some point in time then or soon after were considered like three-fifths.
Correct.
And they didn't address the slavery issue. And of course, Jefferson, Hamilton, Madison, Washington all had slaves. In your view, do you think the fact that they didn't address it then, well, I think there's 2 points why they didn't address it. One is, I'm sure they didn't think they could get a constitution passed with the southern states not endorsing it if they addressed it there. But secondly, it was not in their own best interest financially to try to deal with that issue.
Right.
The first point. Second point on the reparations, and I certainly agree. Well, number one, the fact that we're even talking about it in this forum, I think it's progress, right?
Sure.
And I'll say this, and I hope it doesn't mean that I'm a certified racist, but when you said people say that you give the minority 20,000 or whatever, they'll just waste it, how about if we gave it to them in a way to improve, take inner city Indianapolis, for example.
Sure.
Just to better their life and help them get out of that, because the disparity of in the black versus white socially, we created it. And that's why I see how you can say we're all racist, because we've created that disparity. But if money were directed to start to remove that disparity, wouldn't that be the best approach?
Yeah, and let me just first off say that when you talk to people who have done a lot of thought about the reparations, very seldom do they suggest that giving everyone a check is the best option. However, there are some who do, who say that is a legitimate response. However, I want you to think about our language, and you use this, and this is not to pick on you, because I think often we use this language. It's the language, if we gave them. I mean, think about what that already says about us as a society, the positions of power, who is in power, who isn't, that what we would do in reparations in some sense is an act of kindness and charity. That's not what this is about. It's about justice. You know? And so one of the things we've got to begin to think very carefully about is that kind of thinking in our head, that the reparations wouldn't that be nice if we did that for them? You know, that's not what this is about. You know, it's about justice. It's about a debt that we owe. That's what it's about. I think if you talk to black economists and ethicists, they would share some of your same concerns about how do we do this in a way that in a white supremacist society, if you give a whole bunch of African-American people checks, won't that system just manipulate and exploit them and take that money back? And that's a legitimate fear. You know, so how do you use reparations to do things that that decrease that wealth gap, which is huge? You know, $5 of wealth for a black family for every $100 in a white family. I mean, that's a huge disparity. How do you do things in terms of education in a variety of different ways? And often people say, well, that's just too hard. We can't do that. How would you put something like that together? And I always point out that we did that. We know how to do that. It's called the GI Bill. And the GI Bill was a very intentional, targeted program aimed at millions of men, in this circumstance, coming back from World War II, and how we were going to generate wealth in these men. And it was, we may not realize this, but it was opposed at the time with the very same arguments that are today being made around reparations. They would bankrupt the nation, it's not economically feasible. Almost every argument that you hear today about reparations, you can find in the arguments about the GI Bill. Now, most economists look at the GI Bill now and say it was the single greatest wealth creator of the last century, that economically it was incredible. It created the middle class. But unfortunately, again, as I talked about earlier, it was something that excluded black families. For instance, one of the GI Bill things, GI Bill benefits, was housing loans, you know, cheap, affordable housing loans. Out of the first 100,000 that were granted through the GI Bill, 100 of them went to black families. You know, so you begin to see how even these large programs that were designed to really infuse our country with wealth excluded them. But then, to flip it on its head, we know how to do that. We know how to create a targeted program. And there's some reparational advocates that say, let's just do a GI Bill. Let's do the equivalent of that for African Americans. You know, what would that do? Just to infuse those communities with the same benefits that we gave to those veterans who were coming back after the war. Now, to go back to your first point, yeah, I mean, one of the things I think we have to accept is that our country, unfortunately, was created in the midst of this racial divide. It was created in the midst of slavery. So our very nation has the institutions and evils of this racial divide are embedded in our institutions, are embedded in our most central documents, and we can't escape it. I mean, that's just the way it is. So to deconstruct that is incredibly difficult, you know, because it's so intricately tied to so much of how our nation was created. So, yeah.
Jim.
Sure.
It's my understanding that Great Britain went through reparations, and I think that the last payment was made as recently as 2015. Are you familiar with that?
I'm not. I'm not saying that's not the case. I know that there were some things done. Most of their slaves tended to come from the Caribbean, some of those kind of situations. And I know there were some things done reparationally, but I don't know of any government-wide program. Now, we do have examples of reparations. We know that after World War II, Germany paid reparations to Jewish people. We know here in the United States, we've done reparations for the Japanese. We've done reparations for Native Americans, although some of those were dubious, but you know, that's what they were called. So we know that there's certainly examples of doing reparations. So it's not an alien idea. It's really, you know, it's a legal term. Reparations has a legal understanding. So
I'm sure you've heard this one before, but how about Native Americans? Should they be included?
Yeah, and you know, certainly there have been injustices done to lots of other groups, and Native Americans are certainly a group that's deserving of considerable consideration. However, to put it in context, Native Americans owned black people. The Cherokees, for instance, in the South, and some of those tribes were part of that system. And I certainly don't want to get in a situation where comparing injustices and who had it worse and who had it better. But I think I would argue that there is probably no group that has been as powerfully tortured, robbed, as the American blacks. I think that it would be hard, I think, to argue that any group has been more poorly treated. The Native Americans would probably be a close second. But that being said, would I be open to someone said we need to do some reparational things around Native Americans? I'd be all for it. You know, I think there's some strong arguments for those things. Or, you know, we can look at how the Chinese were treated. In certainly, we already have the example of the Japanese internment camps. So obviously, there are other groups that have some legitimate complaints. You know, so. Well, there is that, you know. Again, I think it's really interesting. The bankruptcy question is not something most economists bring up. Most economists do not think reparations would bankrupt our nation. And I mean, think about it, folks. The Republicans right now are running up a big deficit and arguing that that's good for the economy. So if that's true, why not give $1 trillion to the blacks? You know, that would be a good thing. It would just be adding more to the deficit. So again, I think we want to be careful. When you hear the bankruptcy, whole bankruptcy argument, there's very few economists that would support that. That's a red herring. You know, it's not a real complaint. So. Right. Right. I mean, think about that. If you lift up an entire group of people who have been oppressed in our nation, and you make it more possible for them to live abundant, affluent lives, wouldn't that benefit all of us? Wouldn't that have a trickle-down effect on all of us and throughout our society? So I think you can make a strong argument that that it would be a plus, you know, economically. So.
Yes. I beg to differ with you with respect to the Native American population. They suffered virtual eradication of their population.
Sure.
And what was stolen from them was the United States, whatever that value is today.
Sure.
I think they're probably more aggrieved than perhaps the blacks might be. And, you know, I've thought about reparations. Latinos,
sure.
And for that matter, women have been denigrated for as long as our society has been around.
Sure.
And maybe we're making strides, but not very quickly.
Yeah.
If I might pose a scenario and a question, if the issue of reparations would become an issue that the Democrat Party adopts for this election, and perhaps the Democrat candidate for president would adopt. And if that happens, I'm confident that President Trump would be reelected on that issue alone. And I'm also pretty confident that the U.S. Senate would remain in the hands of the Republican Party, maybe even increase their numbers, and perhaps even the House would go back to the Democrat Party, I mean to the Republican Party.
Mm-hmm.
If those things would occur, what advance do you see have been made for reparations?
Well, I guess the first question is your premise correct that if the Democrats create this as part of their platform that we'll reelect Trump? If that premise is correct, then what the first thing that tells me is that the white supremacy and racism of our country is even more insidious and powerful than any of us guessed, and that that we've got to confront that, you know, and that that is our battle. That the battle is not with Donald Trump; it's with this deep insidious system. The second thing I would say is, let's remember the reparations argument is not a new argument. It's not a new question. It's been going on since 1865. And again and again and again, blacks have been told, it's not right now. You can't make that argument now. You can't do it now. It's not expedient now. We got to wait. You know, King toyed with reparations, said some things close to reparations, and was told, you know, we got the civil rights movement. If you bring that in, you're gonna put an end to that. So I think for most of my black friends I talk to, they get deeply frustrated when they hear white people doing that. You know, it sounds like that same line that they've heard century after century after century. You know, it's not expedient. It's not politically expedient right now. And you know, King finally said, if not now, when? You know? And that's a fair question. When? When's it going to be politically expedient? So I don't know. I mean, I'm not disputing that you might be right. I mean, if that's put on the platform, maybe that means that Trump can use that as a wedge and win the election again. I think that says a lot about our nation. But if the Democratic Party does not include reparations on its platform, that also says a lot about the Democratic Party. So we got to struggle with that. You know, we got to struggle with how we want to understand ourselves. So not easy. Not an easy discussion.
Jim, thanks so much for being here and speaking about this. And what Larry was just talking about, I think, would be even more of an issue if my idea was presented, in that I don't know how effective the tobacco company settlement was, but there was an element of education in there, too. We could think
sure.
of public service announcements. I grew up in the South. I feel my curriculum was so whitewashed.
Right.
That I would like to see something, a fund that's protected, regardless of what, we talk about the threats to Social Security and whatever, but there needs to be some protected fund that would have an educational element that over time would maybe extricate this systemic racism in our
sure.
country's DNA, where... Yeah. And that would even be less likely to be adopted by any candidate, I think, to say, yes, we need to accept responsibility. We need to educate people. We need yeah. to work with the Department of Education and correct the curriculums that are so erroneously being taught to the students.
Yeah. Well, you know, a couple things just to remember. H.R. 40, which is the bill that they were beginning to have some discussions about this week, it's not a bill for reparations. It's a bill to talk about reparations, you know? So let's be clear. The question is, you know, and maybe that's a question, do the Democrats have the courage to just say, talking about reparations should be on our platform, you know? So that's part of it. But Herb, I want to add, I think what your point about education is so key. I just did some reading. A lot of our discussions about race happen with adults. But this is what we know scientifically. We know that four-year-olds recognize racial differences, what we call racial differences. So at four, children do that. We also know by the age of six, they've picked up negative racial stereotypes. And we know by the age of nine, most of those racial stereotypes are embedded. So one of the things I think is clear that if we're really serious about trying to change some of this, it's going to have to be in our educational systems. We're going to have to begin doing some things with our children around race, teaching about race. And it's really interesting to me because raising Ella, we often talk to other parents, white and black, about the discussions we're having with Ella. You know, we talk to her about police brutality. We talk to her about lots of the things that are happening, you know, around us. And it's very interesting, because when we have those discussions with Ella, Black parents almost always tell us they had those discussions with their children 2 to 3 years before we're having them with Ella. And white parents almost always tell us we're having those discussions with Ella too soon, that she's not ready, she's too young for those discussions. Which suggests to me that there's about a 6-year gap between what black children are required to understand in our society and what white children are required to understand in our society. And that is a serious, serious problem. That's part of our privilege, that we protect our white children from these discussions at the expense of black families having to have those discussions with their children. You know? So I think you're right. I think part of this is how do we begin to change things at a very base level? And again, part of our struggle is, what have most white families done to escape the race issue? They've moved away from those schools. They move away from public schools, move away from schools that are integrated. So part of our struggle is that white parents who are racist are probably going to move their children to schools where they don't have to have their children confront issues around race. So that's one of our real dilemmas in terms of education. What happened in Speedway?
What happened in Speedway?
With that situation?
Yes.
Well, and honestly, we let it go, and I feel badly about that. We never confronted that principal. We never confronted the superintendent. And part of it was, at that point, this was all new to us. You know, we hadn't really thought this through. Now, learning to be an advocate, ally, and accomplice with people of color, There are certain things I would have done much differently. I would have gone in and talked to that principal and kind of made it very clear to her, this is what you did. I don't know if you realized, but this is what you did. These are the assumptions you made, and this is how this is going to impact children in your school. And if she had not been responsive to that, then I would have gone to the superintendent and talked to the superintendent about those same things. At the time, what I did is I fled. I took my daughter, put her in a different school, you know. So I'm not proud of that. That was the wrong thing to do. But I've done a lot of education since then, and now understand better how you might want to address that. So.
Yeah, is this thing working?
Yeah, I can hear you. Okay.
I can't hear myself that way. I've been on the receiving end of. I'm trying to be a recovering racist.
Sure.
I've been on the receiving end of anger from black.
Yeah.
About 3 or 4 times, I won't go into all the episodes, and I was quite innocent. I just happened to be it was a pigmentation problem, you know.
Sure.
And I saw this afternoon when Mayor Pete was trying to conduct Mayor Pete was involved in a discussion on a race issue. I saw the anger.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not just black anger. It was there. But the white anger that Larry's talking about is still prevalent.
Sure.
So prevalent. And until we can reduce anger, I don't see anything moving. And
yeah.
You've got to have a program of you know, we talk about the GI Bill.
Mm-hmm.
That sounds good, but there's going to be anger.
Oh, sure.
And
yeah.
You've got to find a format, or we have to find, not you,
yeah.
We have to find a solution that reduces anger, and it might be what we're talking about with education when we start seeing information, but sometimes people don't want to listen.
Yeah.
That's not sometimes, that's oftentimes, they just don't want to hear it. And I'm afraid, and I'm going to make a real pessimistic remark, but... I think the graveyard's going to be the cure for a lot of racism. And I thought it was going away. I've seen some improvements since I was a kid, but I've seen a reemergence, and it's just latent racism that's frightening. And things like that happened up in South Bend today with the anger doesn't do anything to ease it, because we see their anger. How do you keep people from being so ticked off?
Mm-hmm.
And that's both all races, I
yeah.
guess.
I really hear what you're saying. I think the one thing I always try to be careful about is equating black and white anger, because they're not the same. I think white anger has, unfortunately, its roots too often in hatred and resentment. And black anger has its roots in deep pain and injury. And I want to be careful about understanding the differences of those. Now, they manifest themselves sometimes in very similar ways, but they're not quite the same. And we need to be aware of that. So
if I may, we're running really short on time. If we could just do one more back here, and then you're all welcome to continue the conversation downstairs as well.
Thank you. And I agree with the fellow who spoke earlier about trying to get something across in the platform before the election. I think it's for all of us across the country to focus on getting legislators that are like-minded into the positions, president and senators, that can skew the debate and make it an open debate in both houses much better than it can be done today, where it can't.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much.
No, thank you.
This has been a fascinating conversation.
Appreciate your good questions and thoughtful response. Thank you.